All right, well, I'd like to welcome everybody back. This is our fifth week of getting to a talk that we call The Unfinished Story. I believe last time I was up here, I was introing the series, and I made some jokes about never-ending story, and Falcor will not make the same jokes twice. But so what this series of talks is doing, we're looking into the Bible's overall story and purpose by dissecting God's covenants. As the Hebrews understand their own books of law and prophecy and history, there were distinct promises God made with key figures, and these promises were in allusion to his overall purpose. And what was indicative of this was the fact that at each promise, the human part or party would expect something and then see that God had a different thing in mind immediately thereafter, and hilarity ensues. But so just to get into what a covenant is, I know it's a very special word. We have different connotations for it between video games and, you know, different parts of our culture. Covenant has been really overused a lot in media. But what the word originally means is simply a two-way partnership given binding promises and commitments. So it's like simply a partnership with stipulations. And that's kind of a loose definition, but it's kind of a broad word. So the first covenant we looked at was with Noah. With Noah, God made a partnership for peace between his creation and himself, despite the creation's violent, self-serving nature. So God had to basically do a do-over with creation. It had gotten so bad, and we walked through how the story of Noah mimicked the Garden of Eden story in that, okay, we're redoing the partnership, we're starting over, but this time I will have peace with my creation. I will not destroy you again. So that was the first promise. How are we going to do this? Well, then it went into the covenant with Abraham. God made a partnership with Abraham's family to bless the entire earth. In his words, I will bless all nations through your family. Mind you, this included Abraham's enemies and also a nation where Abraham came from, named at the time Babylon, that were also self-proclaimed enemies of Abraham's God. So at this time, God promised all these nations will be blessed through your family, including your enemies. The next week, we looked into God's covenant with Moses. This one was a bit more well-faceted, had a lot of different caveats. But with Moses, essentially God made a partnership for making the tribes of Israel into a nation of priests. And what that means, they would be representing God's ways of mercy and justice to all the other peoples around them, such that they could observe them and know what their God was like. But breaching this contract meant that God would have to make sure that no one confused these people for actual representatives of God. In other words, if you hold up your end of this covenant, you will be accurately representing me and what I value to all the peoples around you, all the nations around you. But if you do not hold up your end of the contract, you will not accurately look like one of my representatives, and then I will have to pull my blessing back from you so that they don't confuse you with my representatives. In other words, if you're actually going to be a representative, I will hold you under my flag and protect you. If you're not, if you're not going to be a good representative, I cannot afford to have the peoples around you thinking that's what I'm like, thinking that I oppress the poor or oppress the alien or just, yeah, I won't get into that. I got into that a lot the first week. So if you want me to get into all the shortcomings of Israel and the shortcomings of their culture at that time and how God wrote a law around it to pull them towards mercy and justice, go check out week one on our website. I'm sure it's written around here somewhere. I'm not going to dart my eyes around too much. But the common thread of all these promises, the common thread of all these covenants is the humans never held up their end of the bargain. So this week, we're going to look at the next to last covenant in the series, and it starts to unravel how God is fixing all these broken promises and also fixing the original problem of us being violent and self-serving. So we're going to park it in the books of Samuel this week, where the people of Israel are demanding a king. So preface this situation, why kings? Why are they worried about that? This is kind of removed from our culture because, what, we haven't had a monarchy for, what, 200 years here at minimum. And in Europe, I think it's probably about 150 years since an actual monarchy was actually in any sort of power. It's all been legislative. So this is kind of removed from our culture, you know, what it's like to have a king, have somebody who, by blood right, tells you what to do and nobody can argue with them. Well, to get some background on this, at first, this is right out the gate. Moses just delivered them, you know, to the promised land. Out the gate, the nation of Israel was 12 loosely affiliated tribes that did not get along. A lot of people kind of missed the part of the 12 separate tribes. You know, why aren't they one people? Why are they 12 tribes? Well, each tribe represented what used to be a brother or an original patriarch, and they did not get along. There's actually verses where God was talking to the tribes and saying, y'all don't intermarry because that's going to cause problems. Marry inside your tribe. Stay inside the tribe. Y'all fight too much. That verse has been misconstrued several times as far as marrying outside your tribe, but it was literally, y'all be quiet, quit fighting, just stay on your side of the car. Like God was talking to his kids in the back, said, just stay on your side. Eyes out that window, eyes out that window. Do not touch, do not look, just stay on your side. That's all that verse was, separating the tribes. They fought too much. But they were also pretty well divided because of this. But they were affiliated, but basically only affiliated by Moses and then Joshua. They were not unified by any stretch of any imagination. And they were surrounded on all sides by strong, centralized, militaristic nations. They were vulnerable to raids and invasions because they had to rely on God to supply judges to defend them. So to picture it, all these nations around them, Canaanites, Philistines, Egypt, they all had a central figurehead that nobody messed with and nobody contradicted. And because they had a central figurehead, their military was fast acting and reactive, and their borders and their culture and their identity was highly enforced. So they were strong, but they were strong by their own means. Look out for me and mine. Have no regard for anybody else. Take what you can, give nothing back, yo-ho. Like, this was the mentality. They looked after their nation and nobody else. And the nation of Israel looked around and they wanted that. They didn't want to rely on God. They didn't want to rely on a way of living. They wanted their own central military leader. They wanted to rely on their own might, on their own understanding, on their own selfishness. But before that, before they started asking for a king, just to give you a background, some of y'all may have been wondering about the books of the Judges, which they were originally books, not book, but books of the Judges. When I say judge, I want you to basically think an action hero. Like, literally, Bruce Willis. They were not role models. Just look at the story of Samson. Hey, Samson, don't do that! Okay, and he does it. And just completely ignores it. They were not role models, but they were God's methods for protecting his people, and he protected this people because he had this partnership with them whereby he wished to bless all peoples through this family. So don't read the book of the Judges to think that, you know, I'm supposed to live like this. No, this is just a story of how God delivered this people to fulfill this promise. It doesn't mean he approves of what the characters are particularly doing. So between Moses and the time of the kings, they had the time of judges, and at this time, they didn't have kings. There were 12 loosely affiliated tribes, and God was protecting them through the judges to hold up this agreement. But God was essentially their king, and his edicts were simply living this particular way in mercy and justice. But as we all often forget, the people lost sight of God's promise and started looking to their own means, taking care of themselves, looking into the worldly, look after me and mind mindset. And so they started asking for a king. So that is why they were looking for kings. But trusting God to raise random heroes while you lived in justice and mercy wasn't glamorous, so the people began to grumble. I'm going to go into 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 through 9 at first. I apologize, I meant to get slides for this, but hey, y'all are way ahead of me. Awesome, Pfeffer, awesome. So, by the way, I'm going to be reading a lot of scripture today because Samuel does a wonderful job portraying the state of mind these people had at this point. So, when Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as the leaders of Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel. The name of his second was Abijah. And they served in Beersheba. But his sons did not follow his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. Sounds like it's going great. So all the leaders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old and your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to us, such as all the other nations have." But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It's not you they've rejected, but they've rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights." So kings were essentially status symbols, celebrities, but they were also military leaders, and while being weak in each of the tribes, a king would unify them and make them an organized power in the region. Notice in the verse, they were looking at what all the other nations had. We want what they have. We want to be like them. But God had given them something better. Like these nations, they pray to idols that do nothing. They don't react. They don't move. And you actually have a God. Why do you need a king to pretend to be a God? Why do you need that? But God also had something else in mind because he knew he was not going to get through to them. So the people wanted to create their own bragging rights and trust their own military strength rather than trust God and live humbly. We are not above that. Case in point, every 4 years. I'm looking around the room and seeing it, who's trying to keep a straight face. We have all done it. We think a change of regime or a change of something else politically is going to solve anything. Well, it hasn't yet. Definition of insanity. If changing the policy does not work, then the change of heart must be the answer, correct? There is no law against rallying a charitable organization, and nothing can limit you in that. Anyway. But God, as he does, he decides to meet them where they were at, like he did last week with the weird animal sacrifice ritual things. He gives them what they want, and he warns them that this military leader with total power will do what military leaders with total powers do. But he planned to use it in a way contrary to what they had wanted. So I'm going to continue in 1 Samuel 8. Ta-da! Y'all are awesome. Samuel told all the words of the Lord that the people who were asking for him to give him a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and his attendants, your male and female servants, and the best of his cattle, or best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles. So also, it's good to make note, fight our battles. Under the Mosaic Covenant, we covered the fact that under this Mosaic Covenant, each member of this nation is supposed to be a priest. They're supposed to live this life. They're supposed to be an example. That was not the case with other nations. They had a figurehead. Sound familiar? And that figurehead was supposed to represent basically the soul of the entire nation. They wanted that. They kind of wanted this king to be the role model and not them. Let somebody more special than me do it. I'm not qualified. Let somebody strong do it. We want to be like them. Let somebody take the responsibility for us. So that was indeed part of it. But also, like I just said, it's important to keep in mind that at the time they took up a king, they're still under that Mosaic covenant. It's a fun word, Mosaic covenant. Matt says yes.
Awesome, Pepper.
So, I originally wanted to read the entire chapter of 1 Samuel 12, but I'm not going to get into it. In 1 Samuel 12, Samuel's giving basically a farewell speech, and he's recounting the results of breaching the Mosaic covenant. And basically, it's like bad TV, it just repeats. Basically, a foreign power would invade after the covenant was breached, and then the people would cry out, like, oh, we're sorry, we're not going to be back. And then a judge would come and rescue them, Bruce Willis. and that was basically it. Just Samuel, literally, his speech is, hey, remember you said you would, then you didn't, then a bad thing happened, and then I delivered you, and then you said you would, and you didn't, a bad thing, and he's basically walking them through, you're going to mess up, and this king's going to make the process happen faster. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, so one person turning real bad, really quick, and if he takes the nation with him, it's going to happen really quick, but if everybody has to be a bad apple before the bunch is bad, that's going to be at least a little bit of control. So, Samuel's trying to warn them, this kingship is going to turn around very bad, very quickly. But essentially, Samuel, at the end of his speech, he's saying, if you represent me, me being God, I'm with you. If you don't represent me, I'm not with you. God couldn't afford other nations believing that he rewarded injustice and corruption. He could not afford it. So being a nation of priests was too much for them. So part of their want for a king was for the king to assume this responsibility of priesthood. Something kind of unique to their nation. But before I get into my next point, I just want to get into the explanation of kings. When the people originally asked for a king, Samuel gave them Saul, who looked like this military king should look like. He was big, he was strong, had a huge suit of armor, he could fight. I mean, he was from a prominent family. He gave them exactly what they wanted. But Saul didn't turn out so well, became corrupted very quickly. So God had a next step. The second king was going to be David. With David, God gave them the best chance at a single king being a good spiritual leader for them. He gave them the best chance at a single king keeping them with God. No other king ever pursued God more than David. And still David failed in a huge way. I'm not going to get into any scriptures about the stories of David, but essentially David, at the onset, he was the underdog, a runt, and all he had was the fact that he trusted his God. And that was it. But as he grew in prominence, he became a bigger and better military leader until eventually he was comfortable and he had one of his best soldiers killed, had a whole huge just scandal, And as a result of that scandal, his children caused civil war, and David himself had to flee. It was just a huge mess. But one thing David was always sincere about was his love for God, because unlike other kings, when a prophet confronted David saying, "You did this, we know, and you know exactly what God thinks of it," David immediately, he doesn't fight back. He doesn't ask for himself to be saved. He's just like, "Okay, what do I need to do?" Showing his intentions. So, you know, the best shot. And all throughout the Old Testament, they constantly refer to David as being, you know, nobody pursued the God like him. And he was the best chance. And he failed. Now what? God gave them David to show them the real problem. No human could hold up their end of the bargain. That was a problem. He picked the best, and it failed. So what now? Well, God didn't decide to go through with the kingship to give them what they wanted for a kingship. He had something else in mind. So this failure was nothing to his plan. It's a common thread of the covenants. You thought I was doing this. Ha! You're cute. So getting into God's other idea for the kingship, I'm just going to go jump into 2 Samuel 7, verses 11 through 16. So this is the actual covenant with David. This is the promise we are looking at this week. Despite David failing miserably, I recommend reading the entire story. It's very cringeworthy. It hurts my heart to read it every time I do. But despite failing miserably, God still makes the promise. "The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish your house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with a rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands. But my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." So, verse 16. I didn't notice this when I was writing this, and it is so awesome that I just see it now. But verse 16, "Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." So the Hebrew authors are literary geniuses, and they have very specific styles. What I want to point out to you in verse 16 is what is called a couplet verse. And it's kind of a three-prong technique. You either make a statement and contradict it, make a statement and come at it from a different angle, or make a statement and say the exact same thing. I'm not going to get into the other twos because I'll be geeking out and going way over time. But, awesome pepper! You're going to have to teach me how to spell that. I know you looked it up. But getting into the last technique of couplet verse, when you make a statement and restatement, that's kind of a, you know, you're talking to your kids. They're on their phone. You know, there's chicken meat in the trash, uncooked. You need to take it out. We don't want to get salmonella. Okay. Yeah, okay. You need to take out the trash. Oh, yeah, okay. Now, same thing with couplet verse. It's to make sure the reader is reading. Because as you read it, it's like, wait, didn't I just read that? Oh, you really want me to get that? So God, talking to David through the prophet Nathan, is like, "I'll establish your kingdom forever. I'll establish your kingdom forever." Oh. Forever, ever? I mean, this was a very violent time in history. I mean, you know, Saul reigned for, almost a decade? And then his entire line is replaced with a different one. David didn't have any illusions about one day somebody else is going to be king, but his family would be around somewhere and kind of cool. No, no, forever, ever. That's a clue that we're not talking about a human. Getting ahead of myself. Next week, Jared, next week. So God promised an eternal kingdom to David, but not how they thought. Jesus just so happens to be from the line of David. This is also a part where I would like to really geek out and get into the other parts of 2 Samuel 7 where it was talking about planting this kingdom and it talks about trees of life and stuff. And then Jesus shows up. He is from Nazareth, which literally translated as stick town. And they called him the Nazarene, the stick man. The stick man from stick town is the stick sprouting from the stump of David's cut off kingship. Perhaps more on that next week, but check it out in the Old Testament. It was hilarious. They were not subtle with saying who Jesus was. But so, in this verse, you may have noticed that it mentioned offspring and doing wrong. I wanted to be careful because I just tied Jesus to this offspring and then this whole doing wrong. Well, does that mean Jesus sinned? Well, God's talking about David's line. There were several allusions in that verse to Solomon building a house. Solomon was actually the one who constructed the temple. So when God was referring to son in this instance, he was talking about all of David's sons behind him. And when they do wrong, I will punish them through the hands of men. That would be Assyria and then Babylon coming and carrying everybody into exile. But your kingdom is going to be established forever. So that promise, you know, hundreds of years from this point in time, when all of Israel has been carried off into exile, there was still this promise of their second and greatest king still having a kingship forever. And they didn't forget that. Check out the Psalms. Sorry, I lost my spot. I tend to do that. Okay, no, I didn't. I'm good. So, the promise to David that his line of kings would not end. I mean, it's clear who I'm alluding to. Jesus is from David's line, and this is the kingdom that was being established. But it's not the standard kingdom. In Jesus' day, they were expecting the new king of David to be a military leader. And you can check out some of the things Jesus' disciples said to him concerning the Romans, where you can see the idea of how they wanted to treat the Romans and how they wanted to respond to the Romans, and then Jesus' immediate response. It was clear this kingdom was not going to be status quo. This eternal king did rise. This king would create a nation of priests to honor a promise to Moses. This king would bless all nations to honor an incredibly one-sided agreement with Abraham. This king would bring the creation to peace with God as assured to Noah. This king would mend all of the previously broken relationships. And if you can't tell, I'm really itching to get into that, but we had another week here. So, to be continued. Next week, the final covenant. So God promised David an eternal lineage and an eternal nation, with David and all of his people having full knowledge that they have broken all prior agreements with God. So this seemed impossible. It looked worse in the centuries following David, with very unpopular prophets telling of a servant king who would defeat all evil by suffering and dying. I'm going to invite the band to go ahead and come back up. So how can one fix people's hearts and the evil of all the world by dying? Who would even be capable of such a feat? Who indeed? Next week. I'm going to pray us into it real quick. So Father God, we thank you for this day. We thank you for giving this time together. And we thank you more than anything for your promises. Despite the fact that we were not and could never be deserving of your promises, you still made them. Because your purpose is not to judge, your purpose is to create. And you've made this very clear from the very beginning. You're the one who brought us here, Lord, and you're the one who's going to make something new out of us. We're waiting for this expectantly and faithfully. We have no doubt in your ability to transform.